Welcome to The Deep Dive, where we cut through the noise and deliver the essential insights you need to be truly well-informed. Today, we're plunging into the formidable, often, unshakable world of banking, and we've got a laser focus on Australia's big four: Commonwealth Bank, Westpac, National Australia Bank, and ANZ. Now, while these institutions have long been seen as bedrock pillars of the Australian economy, they are, as our sources reveal, standing at a critical inflection point. They're grappling with profound structural shifts and a landscape really rife with new challenges.
Exactly. For this deep dive, we've really dissected an in-depth fundamental analysis report on these banking titans. We're looking at everything that makes them tick: their commanding market positions, their current financial health, the strategic directions they're taking, and also the intricate broader economic environment they're operating in. It's about pulling out those really crucial nuggets of understanding.
And that's our mission today, to provide you with a real shortcut to understanding these giants. We're going to try and illuminate the powerful forces shaping their future, highlight their individual strengths, and yes, their vulnerabilities too, and ultimately distill what all of this means for you. Whether you're a customer, perhaps an investor, or simply someone keen to understand the core engine of the Australian economy. So let's start by defining their unique place in the market. When you first look at the Australian banking sector, what immediately jumps out is its extraordinarily concentrated structure. It's often called a quadruply, and that's not just a neat label, it's actually a reflection of incredible market power.
It's true. I mean, these four banks collectively control roughly 3/4 of the entire market. That's huge. We're talking total assets, customer deposits, and really crucially, home loans. And like you said, this isn't just an anecdotal thing. It's quantitatively confirmed. There are economic measures like the Herfindahl-Hirschman Index, the HHI.
Ah, the HHI, right. Regulators use that one.
Exactly. They use it to gauge market concentration. And the levels here, they indicate a significant degree of market power, much more than what you'd typically see in, say, other developed nations.
And historically, this entrenched oligopolistic structure has been, well, an absolute goldmine for them, hasn't it? It's been the primary driver of their superior profitability. It's allowed them to maintain wider net interest margins, or NIMs, that core profit spread.
Yeah, between what they earn on loans and pay on deposits.
Right. And that lets them consistently generate higher returns on equity than almost all of their international counterparts. I mean, think about it. Controlling 3/4 of the market gives you immense pricing power. It's a natural advantage others just can't match. Yet, despite this seemingly, unassailable position, you might be surprised to learn that this competitive landscape isn't static. It's quietly, but profoundly evolving. So, while the Big Four's collective dominance is, well, undeniably formidable, our sources reveal a slow but steady erosion of their market share. It's not a sudden dramatic collapse, more like a persistent, subtle shift. Their combined main financial institution, or MFI, share stood at 67.0% in 2024. And that figure, it has been gradually declining over time.
And even within this dominant group, there's a clear pecking order, isn't there? Commonwealth Bank, CBA, is the undisputed leader. They hold a substantial 32.8% MFI share.
Wow, 32.8%. That's massive.
It is. It's more than double the share of its nearest rivals. You've got ANZ sitting at 11.6%, Westpac at 11.4%, and NA at 11.2%. So while we talk about the Big Four, the power is very much concentrated in that one player, CBA.
And the competitive threats are incredibly diverse. It's not just the big players squabbling amongst themselves. Regional banks and customer-owned institutions, they've long argued that the market structure inherently stifles genuine competition.
Yeah, they've been saying that for years.
And even the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, the ACCC, has formally noted that the retail banking market isn't vigorously competitive.
Mm-hmm.
They point to substantial barriers to entry and expansion for smaller players. Actually, they initially opposed ANZ's acquisition of Suncorp's banking arm.
Right, I remember that.
Precisely because it highlighted just how hard it is for smaller entities to gain meaningful scale organically, which paradoxically really shows you the entrenched nature of the Big Four.
And beyond the traditional challengers, there's this new breed making tangible inroads. The digital-first competitors. Think Macquarie Bank, for instance.
Ah, Macquarie, yeah. They're definitely making waves.
They are. They're steadily gaining MFI share across all age demographics. And they're doing it by cleverly capitalizing on customer switching trends. It's a classic kind of innovator versus incumbent dynamic playing out, but with a unique twist in such a concentrated market.
You're right. Our sources characterize this not as some catastrophic failure, but as a persistent slow leak.
Mm.
They're immense-scale, globally recognized brands, vast physical and digital networks. And let's be honest, the sheer inertia of their colossal customer bases that provides a powerful defense, though, you know, certainly not impenetrable.
No, not completely.
The long-term implication for you, the customer or investor, is this sustained pressure on their profit margins and operating costs. Because these incumbents are forced to aggressively defend their franchises on two key battlefronts, price and technology. So what strikes you about this idea of a slow leak in such a seemingly unassailable market? It's quite something. And speaking of technology, that brings us squarely to where the battle for market share is truly escalating, the digital arms race. You often hear that nimble fintechs are unbundling banking, right?
Yeah.
Picking off pieces of traditional services one by one. You think about companies like Afterpay or Zip, specifically targeting the payment space.
Yeah, the buy now, pay later phenomenon.
Exactly. They focus on a single service and do it exceptionally well,
yeah,
making it incredibly easy for customers. But what's truly fascinating, according to our sources, is how Australia's Big Four aren't just, you know, defending. They're launching a massive rebundling counteroffensive that actually leverages their size in a surprising way.
Well, this surge in fintech innovation is fueled by a perfect confluence of factors. You've got rapidly evolving customer expectations for seamless digital interactions, significantly lower technological barriers to entry for new players, and let's not forget a persistent level of consumer mistrust in the traditional banking sector, particularly after the Banking Royal Commission.
That definitely left a mark.
It did, and the Australian fintech market is poised for substantial growth. Projections put it at reaching USD 9.50 billion by 2033. That's with an impressive 8.90% compound annual growth rate. Even neobanks, those entirely digital-first banks, they're gaining traction, forecasted to grow at over 8% CAGR.
And that's the core of that unbundling concept. Fintechs don't try to be everything to everyone. They chip away at specific services. Neobanks, for instance, even if they're not profitable yet, they exert significant pressure because their digital native models often offer a superior user experience. They're built from the ground up for the digital age, giving them an inherent agility.
Precisely. And in response, the Big Four aren't just reacting. They're proactively trying to rebundle services. This isn't just about defense. It's about reasserting their traditional value proposition as the all-in-one financial provider. And they're doing this in three crucial ways based on the analysis.
Okay, let's break those down. What's the first one?
First, they're pouring billions, literally billions, into enhancing their core digital offerings, aggressively modernizing their mobile apps, their online platforms, and leveraging their immense trove of customer data to create integrated digital ecosystems that go way beyond traditional banking.
Right, like the CommBank app. You mentioned it has, what, 8.5 million active users? And it now features things like travel booking and retail shopping. It's all designed to increase that stickiness, right? Make you less likely to even consider leaving.
Exactly. Keep you inside their walled garden. Second, they've launched flanker brands.
Flanker brands, like separate digital-only banks.
Sort of, yeah. Digital native brands designed to compete directly with those nimble neobanks. Think NA's UBank, CBA's digital mortgage brand Unloan, or ANZ's ANZ Plus platform. These aim to attract younger, tech-savvy customers with a streamlined, low-cost experience, while still benefiting from the parent company's trust, its capital, and its underlying strength. It's a clever strategy.
It is, a way to compete without cannibalizing their main brand too much, perhaps. And the third way.
Third, they're engaging in incredibly smart strategic partnerships. They recognize they can't possibly build every innovative solution in-house. It's just too slow and expensive. So they're actively forming alliances and making strategic investments in fintech companies to rapidly acquire new capabilities.
I've seen you some examples.
Sure. We've seen CBA partnering with Mambu for Unloan's core banking platform and with Paperplane for payments innovation. And ANZ has collaborated with Frollo for open banking data aggregation and with CitoPlus for streamlining SME loans. It's a pragmatic way to innovate quickly, tap into external expertise without the massive internal development costs, and importantly, time.
Yeah, time is critical in this space.
Absolutely. What's truly insightful here is how these established incumbents are not merely defending their turf. They're innovating aggressively. They're trying to reassert their value proposition in this rapidly evolving digital-first world. And the success of this comprehensive digital strategy, it will be a critical determinant of their ability to defend market share and maintain that one-stop-shop advantage in an increasingly fragmented financial services landscape.
It's a huge undertaking. And all of this, of course, unfolds within a very specific and impactful framework. Australia's highly stringent regulatory environment. When we talk about Australian banking, we absolutely have to discuss the regulatory environment. It's primarily overseen by the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority, or APRA, and Australia's banking system operates within one of the world's most stringent and, frankly, conservative regulatory frameworks.
That's right. APRA's core mandate is stability, full stop. And they enforce that through comprehensive prudential standards covering everything from capital adequacy, risk management, governance to liquidity. A real cornerstone of this is the requirement for unquestionably strong capital levels.
And unquestionably strong. That sounds serious.
It is. These levels are well in excess of the global Basel III Accords. It means they have to hold a lot more capital as a buffer against losses compared to banks in many other countries.
And the regulatory landscape was also profoundly shaped by that 2018 Royal Commission, wasn't it? The one into misconduct in the banking, superannuation, and financial services industry.
Oh, absolutely. That was a watershed moment. It led to a permanent and significant uplift in spending on compliance, risk management, and remediation. Basically, these costs are now embedded. They're an inescapable and substantial feature of their financial structures going forward. It's not temporary.
And another key regulatory initiative aimed at fostering competition this time is the consumer data right, or open banking. This is designed to give you, the consumer, secure access to your financial data. Theoretically, it should make it easier to compare products and switch providers, boosting competition.
Theoretically, yes. Now, adoption has been quite slow so far. Our sources say only about 0.31% of bank customers were actually using it at the end of 2023.
That's tiny.
It is. But the government is clearly committed to extending its scope, so its influence on competition and transparency will likely only grow over time. It's one to watch.
Okay. And we can't overlook the Reserve Bank of Australia, the RBA, setting monetary policy.
And APRA's complementary macroprudential policies, yeah. Things like those interest rate serviceability buffers for mortgages, these are all designed to ensure prudent lending standards and maintain overall systemic financial stability.
So this comprehensive regulatory framework, it really sounds like a double-edged sword for the banks.
That's a good way to put it.
On one hand, it creates a formidable barrier to entry. It protects the profitable oligopoly and ensures systemic stability, which is a huge positive for long-term confidence.
Right, definitely. Stability is the primary goal.
But on the other hand, it imposes a direct and material drag on their financial returns.
Mm-hmm.
Those high capital requirements suppress return on equity, ROE,
yeah.
And the ever-increasing compliance costs just add to an already high cost base.
And there's also APRA's recent move to a three-tiered regulation approach. This might actually lower the burden on smaller competitors, which could potentially intensify competitive pressure on the big four down the track by allowing those smaller players to grow more easily.
Interesting. So an investment here is really in a system explicitly designed for safety and stability,
mm-hmm.
potentially at the expense of high growth and capital efficiency.
Which raises that critical question again. How much more can they squeeze out of their core business when safety itself comes at such a significant and escalating cost? Can they maintain that profitability?
That's the crucial point. So with this understanding of the broader market and regulatory landscape, let's peel back another layer. Let's look at the engine room itself, how these banks actually make their money, and what forces are now squeezing those very profits.
Okay, let's dig deeper into the core banking concept. How do they actually make money? Well, the big four banks primarily generate their revenue from something called net interest income, or NII.
Right, NII. It's the fundamental difference between the interest they earn on their assets, which are overwhelmingly the loans they provide to households and businesses,
yeah.
and the interest they pay out on their liabilities, like your customer deposits and the money they borrow themselves, their wholesale funding.
And interestingly, they've recently reported record high absolute NII, which sounds great on the surface. This is largely thanks to significant loan portfolio growth. They're simply lending out more money overall.
Essentially, it's the core banking spread, the price they charge for lending versus what they pay for borrowing or holding funds. This is the absolute heart of their business model. It's their primary profit engine. But, and this is big, but while those total dollar amounts look substantial, The underlying profitability of this core activity, well, it's actually facing significant headwinds. There's a crucial squeeze happening.
Exactly. Which leads us to where it gets really insightful.
Despite those big dollar amounts, the underlying profitability of their core lending activity is being squeezed. Let's talk about why. So we're talking about net interest margins, NIMs, again, that critical ratio of NII to their average interest-earning assets. And our sources confirm these are under what's described as significant and sustained pressure.
Yeah, this compression, this squeeze, it's due to several converging factors, creating a real pincer movement on margins. First, intense competition. We touched on this earlier. The mortgage market in particular has forced them to offer sharply priced loans.
Meaning lower interest rates just to win business.
Pretty much, just to attract and retain customers. Everyone is vying for that same home loan borrower, leading to thinner profit margins on each loan they write. Second, on the other side of the ledger, there are funding costs. Fierce competition for customer deposits has driven up their costs significantly.
Because customers are moving money around.
Exactly. Customers are increasingly sophisticated. They're shifting their savings from low-rate transaction accounts to higher-yielding term deposits, simply seeking better returns on their money. Banks have to pay more to keep those deposits.
Makes sense. And there's a third, more systemic factor.
Yes, a massive one impacting all of them. The final repayments of the Reserve Bank of Australia's Cheap Term Funding Facility, the TFF, that concludes in mid-2024. This facility provided banks with a significant source of very low-cost funding during the pandemic designed to support lending.
Right, that cheap money pipeline.
That's it. Now that it's being repaid, banks are forced to replace that cheap money with more expensive funding sources, things like wholesale debt, which costs more, and those higher-cost customer deposits we just talked about. So this combination, pressure on what they earn on loans and pressure on what they pay for funding, it creates an incredibly challenging environment for margin expansion.
A real squeeze from both sides.
Precisely. And it's also important to briefly touch on non-interest income here.
Okay, what falls under that?
This includes revenues from things like account fees, wealth management services, institutional banking fees, that sort of thing. Now, after the Royal Commission, the banks largely divested their vertically integrated wealth management and insurance businesses.
Right, they simplified things.
They did. And while that decision simplified operations and certainly reduced regulatory risk, it also removed a valuable source of diversified capital-light earnings, meaning they are now more reliant than ever on that core lending business, which, as we've established, is increasingly squeezed.
So more eggs in one slightly shrinking basket. What about their overall business mix?
Well, their primary focus remains squarely on Australia and New Zealand. That's their bread and butter. ANZ has historically had a more pronounced institutional and international footprint, particularly in Asia, which offers some diversification, yes, but also exposes them to different geopolitical and economic risks.
Sure.
CBA, Westpac, and NA, however, are more heavily weighted towards domestic retail and business banking. Their profitability is truly driven by these core segments, and recent trends show strong growth in business lending, and actually a deliberate decline in higher-risk, unsecured consumer lending, like credit cards and personal loans.
Which makes sense given the current economic climate, right? Cost of living pressures on households.
Exactly. It's prudent risk management in this environment. So when we connect all these dots, the margin pressure, the reliance on core lending, the rising costs, it's clear they're fighting a multi-front war on their profitability. And this makes rigorous cost control not just important, but absolutely paramount for their future financial health.
Okay. Absolutely critical. Now, let's turn to the quality of those loans they're making, because that's where the biggest financial risk lies for any bank, isn't it? Let's discuss the composition and, crucially, the health of these banks' loan portfolios. Our sources clearly indicate their portfolios are overwhelmingly dominated by residential mortgages.
Massively so.
Which makes their performance intrinsically linked to the health of the Australian housing market. In essence, the housing market isn't just a factor. It's their single largest risk sensitivity. Everything hinges on it.
That's right. Beyond mortgages, business lending, especially to those small and medium-sized enterprises, SMEs, is another key strategic focus and growth area, particularly for NA, as we noted. But the key trend right now is this, after a period of exceptionally benign conditions.
Meaning very few defaults or problems with loans.
Exactly. Almost historically low levels of trouble. But now, asset quality is beginning to normalize. Now, let's be clear. Overall loan losses remain remarkably low by historical standards. We're not talking about a crisis. But there are clear signs of stress emerging in specific segments.
Okay, what kind of signs are we seeing?
Well, the value of impaired assets, that's loans where borrowers are struggling to make payments, is growing faster than the overall loan portfolio itself. And non-performing loans, or NPLs, they're trending upwards from what was a cyclical trough, a real low point.
So things are ticking up, albeit from a very low base.
Correct. And this deterioration is primarily driven by the housing loan portfolio. Some households are definitely struggling with the combined impact of high inflation and the rapid increase in interest rates we've seen over the past couple of years. And those mortgages that are 30 to 89 days past due, that's an important early indicator of future stress. Those have also increased.
So it's like a slow, steady tide coming in, maybe signaling areas of increasing pressure.
That's a good analogy. It's not a tsunami, but the water level is definitely rising.
But despite these emerging signs of stress, there's been a crucial mitigating factor, something that has, so far at least, shielded the banks from major losses. And it all comes back, again, to the resilience of the Australian housing market. Let's unpack the surprising resilience that has kept actual credit losses so remarkably low. Despite the increased arrears we just discussed, the actual money banks have lost have remained exceptionally low. Why is that?
It's primarily due to what our sources consistently call the remarkable resilience of the Australian housing market.
Okay, how does that resilience act as a safety net?
Well, persistently strong property prices mean that even when borrowers face severe financial stress, maybe they lose their job, can't make mortgage payments, the high value of their property, which is the bank's collateral.
The security for the loan.
Exactly. That high value often allows them to sell the asset, maybe downsize or move, and repay their debt in full. So even though the borrower defaulted in terms of payments, the bank doesn't actually incur a capital loss on the loan itself because the property sale covered the debt. This dynamic effectively insulates banks from incurring large losses, even when arrears are rising.
It's like having a very robust safety net beneath a tightrope walker. If they wobble, the net catches them before they hit the ground hard. However, our sources also discuss the perfect storm scenario, don't they? The kind modeled in APRA's stress tests.
They do. These are severe but plausible scenarios designed to test the bank's resilience. The perfect storm would involve a sharp fall in house prices, say a 40% decline, for example.
Wow, 40%.
Combined with a significant rise in the unemployment rate. This combination would be particularly damaging because it would simultaneously trigger a wave of new defaults and drastically impair the value of the bank's primary form of collateral, the houses themselves.
So the safety net shrinks just as more people are falling.
Precisely. That would lead to a substantial increase in actual credit losses for the banks. So for you, whether you're considering property or bank stocks, the outlook for the housing market remains the critical variable for understanding bank performance and risk.
Absolutely crucial.
It really raises a profound question. How long can this safety net truly hold, especially if economic conditions were to shift significantly? And what would a fundamental, sustained downturn in the housing market truly mean for these bedrock institutions? It's the big what if.
It really is. Okay, so we've looked at the big picture for the banking sector, the forces at play, how they make their money, the risks. Now let's drill down. Let's dissect each of the big four individually. Because while they operate in the same environment, they each have their own distinct story and strategic focus.
Right.
Let's zoom in now. Because while they're often lumped together as the big four, each of these banks has a truly distinct story, a unique strategic approach. First up, the 800-pound gorilla, Commonwealth Bank of Australia, CBA. The undisputed market leader.
Undisputed is right. CBA truly stands as the largest bank in Australia by almost any measure. Market capitalization, total assets, and crucially, its vast customer base. Its dominance is most evident in retail banking. They hold the leading market share in both home loans and household deposits. And remember that MFI share number. 32.8%.
More than ANZ and NAB combined.
Exactly. It just illustrates their formidable position. And they're active in the 2024 financial year alone. CBA helped over 120,000 customers purchase homes and extended a massive $39 billion in new business lending.
Just huge numbers. And when it comes to operational efficiency, CBA has historically been the industry benchmark, haven't they?
They have, though their cost-to-income ratio did rise slightly to 45.0% in FY24. That reflects some industry-wide wage inflation and, importantly, the significant ongoing technology and risk investments that all banks are making. But the digital leadership remains absolutely core to their model. That 8.5 million active users on the CommBank app, That's a market-leading figure and testament to their digital focus.
So how does their scale play into their strategy?
Well, CBA's immense scale creates a kind of virtuous cycle. It provides a structural funding cost advantage. Think about all those low-cost deposits they attract. And it generates the financial capacity for massive investments in technology, marketing, product development. Things smaller competitors simply cannot match. Plus, their brand reputation is exceptionally strong. It's almost a default choice for many Australians.
So their strategy leverages that.
Absolutely. It's all about leveraging this digital leadership to, as they put it, reimagine banking, creating integrated, personalized customer experiences supported by those sophisticated partnerships we mentioned, like with Mambu for Unloan and Paperplane for payments. They're trying to be indispensable in your financial life.
And financially, how do they stack up in FY24?
Pretty strong. They reported a cash net profit after tax of $9.8 billion, a robust return on equity, ROE, of 13.6%, and a strong common equity tier 1, or CET1, capital ratio of 12.3%, all while maintaining that 45.0% cost-to-income ratio. They really are the premium player, operating at a different level of profitability and scale compared to their peers.
Okay, the clear leader. Now let's shift our gaze to Westpac. You mentioned earlier they're in the midst of a very ambitious turnaround story, right, Westpac. Often positioned, as you say, as a potential value and turnaround opportunity. Still huge, of course, the second largest bank in Australia by assets. And they hold a strong position in the mortgage and household deposit markets, number two behind CBA.
That's right. But for several years now, the bank has been relentlessly focused on simplification, divesting non-core assets, getting rid of complexity, and diligently addressing a legacy of risk and compliance issues that had built up over time.
And improving efficiency is key to this turnaround.
Absolutely central. It's the core strategic narrative right now. Their cost-to-income ratio has been elevated in the past, partly due to a more complex sort of sprawling structure compared to someone like CBA. So they've launched Unite.
Unite. What's that?
It's a major multi-year simplification program, really ambitious. The aim is to modernize their technology, consolidate fragmented systems. They gave an example of reducing three separate deposit processing systems down to just one.
That sounds like a big job.
It is. And the ultimate goal is to fundamentally create a lower cost, simpler operating model. They also successfully completed their customer outcomes and risk excellence program called CORE. And that led APRA to reduce a $500 million operational risk capital overlay, which was a significant positive signal from the regulator, showing progress on risk issues.
So the investment case really hangs on executing Unite successfully.
It really does. That's the crux of it. Success hinges on that execution. They're also intensely focused on improving customer service, particularly trying to reduce those lengthy mortgage approval times, which has been a known competitive pain point for them.
Get those loans approved faster.
Exactly. If they can deliver on those promised efficiency gains from Unite, there's significant potential for their valuation to re-rate, you know, bringing their profitability metrics closer to those of their more efficient peers like CBA or Nangbi.
So high stakes, but potentially high reward if they pull it off.
Yeah, what's particularly insightful here is the sheer scale of the complexity Westpac is tackling and the potential upside if they succeed in their simplification efforts. Looking at their FY24 numbers, a net profit of $7.0 billion, a return on tangible equity, ROTE, of 11.0%, and a CET1 capital ratio of 12.5%. Mm-hmm. The success of Unite will clearly be the key to unlocking further value for this institution.
Okay, a major transformation underway at Westpac. Now, from that large-scale transformation, let's turn our attention to a bank that has carved out a very strong and defensible niche for itself, National Australia Bank, or NAB. NAB, their strategic differentiator seems absolutely clear and consistent, doesn't it? They are Australia's largest business bank.
Unequivocally. That leadership in the business and SME, small and medium-sized enterprise segment, provides a strong foundation. It's a relationship-driven earnings base that is arguably less commoditized and less volatile than the fiercely competitive retail mortgage market.
So a bit more stable, perhaps.
Potentially, yes. And while they are certainly a significant player in home lending, NABI approaches this segment with a disciplined focus, prioritizing returns over just chasing sheer volume or market share at any cost. They also maintain a very strong corporate and institutional banking franchise alongside their business bank dominance.
And how are they doing on the efficiency front? Westpac's got Unite. What's NAB's story?
NEBI has made significant strides here, too. They delivered $453 million in productivity benefits in FY24 alone. And this has been crucial in containing their operating expense growth, resulting in a respectable cost-to-income ratio of 46.6%, not quite CBA level, but solid. And furthermore, over 93% of their customer interactions now occur digitally, showing a strong embrace of technology to support efficiency.
So what's their core strategy, boiled down?
It's fundamentally centered on their relationship-led banking model, especially within business banking. They're investing heavily in digital tools and data analytics, but the key point is it's not to replace those human relationships with bankers. It's to enhance them, giving their bankers superior tools to serve clients more effectively.
Augmenting the relationship, not automating it away.
Precisely. Mm. And in the retail space, they have their digital-only brand, UBank, which successfully attracts younger, digitally savvy customers with a distinct low-cost value proposition. It serves as a clever flanker brand, similar to what the others are doing.
Got it. And their FY24 numbers.
NAB reported cash earnings of $7.1 billion, a cash return on equity of 11.6%, and a CET1 capital ratio of 12.35%. Their focused leadership in business banking truly gives them a unique competitive edge within the Big Four, a clear identity.
Okay. The business bank leader. And finally, let's explore ANZ. You describe them as making a bold and truly transformative strategic pivot. Right, ANZ. Currently undergoing a major strategic pivot that's really reshaping its entire identity. Traditionally, they've been distinguished by having a strong institutional banking franchise and a more expansive international network, particularly across Asia compared to the others.
That's historically been their profile, yes. But now they're making a decisive shift back towards domestic retail and commercial banking, a rebalancing act.
And the cornerstone of this new strategy is that huge acquisition of Suncorp Bank.
Absolutely. That's the landmark deal. It's truly transformative. It's designed to significantly increase ANZ's scale and market share in Australian retail and commercial banking, especially in the rapidly growing state of Queensland, where Suncorp had a strong presence.
What about their efficiency? We heard CBA's low, Westpac's working on it, NAB's solid. Where does ANZ sit?
Well, ANZ has historically faced challenges here. The data shows them having the highest operating expenses to operating income ratio among the Big Four. It was 51.3% in FY24, which clearly indicates a need for substantial cost improvement as part of this pivot.
So integrating Suncorp efficiently will be crucial. What's their tech focus?
Their key technology focus is what they term a dual platform future.
Dual platform.
Yeah. It involves concurrent substantial investment in two major platforms. Their new retail digital platform, ANZ Plus, which is getting a lot of attention.
Yeah.
And also upgrading their institutional platform, ANZ Transactive Global. So investing heavily on both fronts.
And the overarching strategy.
Their stated aim is to build a simpler, better bank, focused on improving financial well-being for customers, supporting housing, and enabling sustainability. ANZ Plus is the primary vehicle for that in retail, and it's showing strong early momentum in customer and deposit growth. They're also cleverly leveraging open banking, allowing customers to view accounts from other banks directly within the ANZ Plus app itself. That's quite innovative.
Trying to be the main dashboard for your finances.
Kind of, yeah. And furthermore, like the others, they are actively partnering with fintechs. We mentioned Frollo for data insights and Sitta Plus for SME loans. Again, accelerating digital capabilities through collaboration.
And their financials for FY24.
ANZ reported a cash profit of $6.9 billion, though that excludes some one-off impacts from the Suncorp acquisition costs. Their ROE was 12.2%, and their CET1 capital ratio stood at 12.2%. Their ability to successfully integrate Suncorp, realize the promised synergies, and manage the costs. That will be absolutely critical for their future performance and the success of this whole strategic rebalance. It's a big bet.
A huge bet indeed. Okay, so after dissecting each of these institutions, their strategies, their numbers, what does this all mean for them as potential investments and for the broader sector outlook? Now that we've looked at each bank's unique story, let's pull back again. Let's consider the broader financial landscape, including risks, returns, and the road ahead.
Right. Let's summarize the overarching profitability trends for the Big Four as a group. Our sources indicate that profitability, measured by that key metric return on equity, or ROE, has definitely moderated. It's come down from the cyclical peaks we saw in the immediate post-pandemic recovery phase.
That's right. The combined profit after tax for the majors was $29.9 billion in FY24, which was actually down 5.7% from the prior year, and the average ROE declined 80 basis points at 10.9%. So a noticeable dip.
Although within the group, as we saw, CDA consistently delivers superior ROE, hitting that 13.6% in FY24. Correct. They remain the outlier in profitability. But the general outlook for profitability remains challenging. Expected interest rate falls, while potentially good for borrowers, tend to add pressure to NIMs. And those ongoing significant technology and compliance investments are keeping costs elevated across the board.
But despite the profit moderation, there's a core undeniable strength, isn't there? Their balance sheets.
Absolutely. They're exceptionally strong balance sheets. That's the phrase used. All four banks are robustly capitalized. That average common equity tier 1 CET1 ratio is around 12.3%, which is comfortably above APRA's unquestionably strong benchmarks. It provides a massive buffer to absorb potential losses, even in a significant downturn.
A huge safety cushion.
It is, and their funding profile has also strengthened considerably since the global financial crisis. Customer deposits now represent a higher proportion of their total funding, making them less reliant on those sometimes volatile wholesale markets for money, and their liquidity positions are also robust. The average liquidity coverage ratio, or LCR, is at 134.5%, well above the 100% regulatory minimum. They have plenty of liquid assets on hand.
So they're safe, stable. But as mature businesses generating substantial surplus capital, their capital allocation strategy becomes absolutely key for investors, right?
Yeah.
What do they do with that profit?
Exactly. It's crucial. They are committed to high dividend payout ratios. CBA's was 79% in FY24, NABIS was 73.7%, high proportions of profit returned to shareholders. And crucially, these are typically fully franked dividends.
Ah, franking credits. Very important for Australian investors.
Very important. It means the corporate tax paid by the bank is effectively credited back to the shareholder, reducing their personal tax burden. It offers attractive tax-effective income. They also actively use on-market share buyback.
Buying back their own shares.
Yes, as another way to return surplus capital to shareholders and also to manage their ROE by reducing the total equity base. But this combination, the high mandatory capital they have to hold, the intense margin competition squeezing profits, and those rising operational costs, it creates a kind of structural ceiling on their sustainable ROE.
Meaning those super high returns from before the GFC are gone for good.
Highly unlikely to return. Getting back to those pre-GFC high-teen ROEs seems very improbable in this environment. So for you, the investor, disciplined capital management, how they use buybacks and dividends and rigorous cost control are now the most critical levers for generating shareholder value. Growth is harder to come by.
It shifts the focus.
It does. And it raises that important question for investors. Can they continue to deliver attractive returns when the traditional levers of high growth and expansive margins are so constrained by regulation and competition?
A key question indeed. And beyond the numbers, beyond profitability and capital, there are evolving risks that demand our attention. Risks extending far beyond just credit losses. Okay, so credit risk, the risk of losses from borrowers defaulting, that remains the primary financial risk, right?
Yeah.
And it's currently normalizing from those very low levels we discussed. The key sensitivities remain the Australian housing market and the SME sector.
Correct. And provisions, the money set aside for expected losses, are generally seen as adequate for a base case economic scenario. But they would be severely tested by a sharp rise in unemployment or a significant sustained fall in house prices, that perfect storm scenario again. APRA's stress tests do show the banks are resilient enough to survive severe downturns thanks to that high capital, but their profitability would certainly be materially impacted. Earnings would take a big hit.
But you said risks are evolving beyond credit.
Absolutely. Operational and strategic risks are becoming increasingly structural and, frankly, significant for these banks. Technology and cybersecurity, for example. This has emerged as a major and growing systemic risk across the entire financial system, not just for banks.
Because everything is digital now.
Pretty much. The bank's increasing reliance on digital platforms, cloud computing, third-party vendors, it just amplifies their exposure. Exposure to sophisticated cyber attacks, data breaches, online fraud, scams targeting customers. Regulators are highly focused on this, and rightly so. A significant cyber incident could result in substantial financial losses, severe regulatory penalties, and devastating reputational damage.
The fallout could be huge.
It could. And there's also significant execution risk associated with those large-scale, multi-year technology transformation projects we talked about, like Westpac's Unite or ANZ's Dual Platform Future. These are massive, complex undertakings.
What's the risk there? Things going wrong.
Delays, cost overruns, or simply a failure to realize the projected benefits, the cost savings, or the new capabilities. These pose material risks to their profitability and their competitive positioning if they don't deliver as promised.
Okay, so tech risk, execution risk. What else?
Regulatory and compliance risk remains intense. It hasn't gone away. The risk of substantial fines and penalties for non-compliance, particularly in areas like anti-money laundering and counterterrorism financing, AML/CTF, is consistently high. These fines can be enormous. And then there are the ongoing costs of simply adhering to the heightened conduct and governance standards that came out of the Royal Commission, plus constantly adapting to evolving prudential standards from APRA. It all adds to operational complexity and puts continuous pressure on the cost base.
So it's clear it's not just the loans they have to worry about anymore. It's the very infrastructure they run on, the digital frontier they're pushing into, and the intricate regulatory environment they operate within, all demanding constant vigilance and massive investment. And these risks, along with the individual bank performance we discuss, profoundly influence how the market values these institutions. And there's a fascinating divergence there to unpack, isn't there?
Yes, our source and highlight what they call a stark and persistent divergence in valuation among the big four. It's truly a tale of two tiers, maybe even three, and it's critical for investors to understand this gap.
It really is stark. Let's look at the current valuation metrics based on mid-2025 data in our sources. Commonwealth Bank, CBA, traded a significant premium to all its peers, a huge premium. Its price-to-earnings, or PE ratio, is roughly 28 to 30 times earnings.
Wow, that's high for a bank. Very high. And its price-to-book, or PB, ratio is exceptionally high at approximately 3.9 times its book value. Consequently, because the price is so high relative to earnings and dividends, it offers the lowest dividend yield, only about 2.7%.
Okay, so CBA is the expensive one. What about the others?
Well, Westpac and Abbey trade at far more modest and, interestingly, quite comparable multiples to each other. Westpac's PE is around 16, 17 times, its PB is about 1.5 times, and its dividend yield is approximately 4.7%. Abbey is very similar, PE of 16, 17 times, PB of about 1.9 times, and a yield around 4.4%.
So roughly half the PE multiple of CBA.
Roughly, yeah. And then there's ANZ, which is currently the cheapest of the group based on these metrics. Its PE is about 13, 14 times. Its PB is around 1.2 times book value. And because its price is lower relative to its dividend, it offers the highest dividend yield at approximately 5.7%.
Quite a spread there. How does the market justify CBA's massive premium?
Well, the argument is usually based on its higher and more stable return on equity, its dominant market leadership that we discussed, and a perceived lower overall risk profile, the safe haven argument.
But do analysts agree?
Not necessarily. Many analysts, according to our sources, view CBA as fundamentally overvalued at these levels. Consensus price targets from brokers are often significantly below its current market price. Just for perspective, theoretical valuation models, like the Gordon Growth Model.
Okay, getting technical now.
Briefly, it basically links ROE, growth, and cost of equity to a theoretical PB ratio, using reasonable assumptions for banks, like a cost of equity around 10%, growth maybe 3-4%. CBA's current 13.6% ROE would theoretically justify a PB ratio somewhere between 1.5x and 1.7x.
But it's trading at nearly 4x book value.
Exactly. That massive gap, nearly 4.0x, implies the market is either pricing in a much, much lower cost of equity for CBA, like an unprecedented safety premium, or it's expecting an unlikely dramatic increase in its ROE from already high levels. Or, as some analysts argue, it's simply caught in a valuation bubble, perhaps driven by its large index weighting and that safe haven reputation attracting passive flows. The bottom line is, this suggests CBA carries significant derating risk. The risk its valuation multiple could fall back towards the sector average.
That makes sense. A long way to fall.
It is. What's truly fascinating here is how the market is placing such an extraordinarily high premium on perceived safety, potentially at the expense of future returns. So when we assess potential risk-adjusted returns going forward,
how do they stack up?
Well, CBA appears to offer the lowest potential forward returns simply because it's already priced for flawless performance. Its primary risk isn't necessarily fundamental business deterioration, but that potential derating of its valuation. You're paying a very high price for perceived quality.
Okay, what about Westpac and ANZ?
Westpac and ANZ offer higher potential for capital appreciation if their ambitious strategies are executed successfully. That's Westpac's big cost-out program with Unite and ANZ's large, complex Suncorp integration. Now, they do inherently carry higher execution risk. These things could go wrong. But their more modest starting valuations offer a greater margin of safety for investors. More room for error, perhaps.
NAB.
NB presents a more balanced risk-reward profile. Its strong, defensible business banking franchise provides a stable earnings base. It's likely to offer solid, market-like returns with moderate risk, kind of the middle ground.
Really interesting divergence.
Yeah.
Okay, so with all that in mind, the market dynamics, the individual bank strategies, the risks, the valuations, where do we go from here? What external forces and key events will truly shape the narrative for these banks in the coming months and years? #4.4 macroeconomic sensitivities and future catalysts. Let's shift our gaze to the horizon now, the big picture stuff. Because from interest rates to the housing market, these external macroeconomic forces are absolutely massive drivers for the banks, often outweighing their individual strategies, wouldn't you say?
Oh, completely. They operate within the broader economy. They don't exist in a vacuum. The interest rate environment is a critical one right now. The prospect of RBA rate cuts, whenever they might come, presents a genuinely mixed outlook for banks.
Mixed. How so? Good and bad.
Exactly. On the positive side, lower rates obviously ease pressure on borrowers, which helps contain credit losses. That's good for asset quality. And lower rates typically support overall loan demand, spurring some growth. However, on the negative side, falling rates are generally a headwind for net interest margins.
Why is that?
Because banks' assets, their loans, especially variable rate mortgages, tend to reprice downwards faster than their liabilities, their deposits. And that intense deposit competition we discussed earlier means they can't easily pass on the full extent of rate cuts to savers. They have to keep deposit rates relatively attractive to hold on to funding. So falling rates often squeeze margins further.
Okay, so rate cuts are a double-edged sword too. What about the broader economy?
Well, the banks are incredibly sensitive to the overall economic cycle. Their performance is highly correlated with domestic GDP growth, the unemployment rate, consumer confidence, business investment, all the key indicators. A robust economy translates directly to strong credit growth and low loan losses. Happy days for banks. Conversely, a recession would lead to a contraction in lending demand, a sharp rise in bad debts, and a significant fall in profitability.
Though they are capitalized to withstand it now.
Yes. APRD stress tests show they are capitalized to withstand severe downturns thanks to those unquestionably strong levels. They won't collapse, but their earnings and their share prices would certainly be materially impacted in a recession.
And that brings us back, inevitably, to the housing market.
Inevitably. It remains the single largest macroeconomic sensitivity purely because of the overwhelming dominance of residential mortgages in their loan books. A stable or gently rising housing market provides a supportive backdrop. Good for credit growth, good for asset quality, good for the value of their collateral. However, a significant and sustained downturn remains the key tail risk, the big scary scenario.
Why sustained?
Because a short dip might not cause widespread default if unemployment stays low, but a sustained downturn would not only curtail new lending activity, it would also severely increase actual losses on defaulting loans by reducing the recovery rates banks get when they eventually have to sell repossessed properties. That safety net shrinks.
Right. Makes sense. So given all these sensitivities, what should you, our listener, be watching for? Are there key events or data points coming up?
Yes, there's definitely a catalyst timeline to keep an eye on, according to our sources. On an ongoing quarterly basis, watch for APRA's quarterly ADI statistics that gives timely data on in-arm trends, capital levels, liquidity, asset quality trends across the industry.
The official scorecard.
Pretty much. Also, the RBA's financial stability review, which comes out semi-annually, and their monthly board minutes. These are crucial for understanding the central bank's assessment of systemic risks and their outlook for monetary policy. Looking ahead, probably into the second half of 2025 and the first half of 2026, based on current market thinking, anticipated RBA interest rate decisions will undoubtedly be a primary driver of market sentiment and IM forecasts and credit cost expectations.
All eyes on the RBA.
Always. And specifically for the banks, in FY25 and FY26, keep an eye on Westpac's Unite program updates. Those will be critical indicators of their cost reduction execution. And similarly, ANZ's Suncorp Bank integration updates. Are they realizing the promised synergies? How are they managing the execution risks? That will be key for ANZ's story.
And regulatory updates.
Yes. On an ongoing basis, keep an eye on regulatory and government updates. Things like the expansion of the consumer data right, open banking, further payment system reforms, any other changes to the regulatory framework. These can have a material impact on their operating environment and costs.
Lots to track.
There is. Our sources allude to various scenarios, base case, bull case, bear case, illustrating how these different factors could play out. It just highlights the range of possible futures for these banks, depending on how these catalysts unfold.
So for you, whether you're a customer, an investor, or simply interested in the backbone of the Australian economy, what stands out to you is the single biggest external factor rates, housing, regulation, competition that will shape these banks' future. It's a lot to weigh up. Hashtag, hashtag, tag, outro. So after peeling back all these layers, what's the big picture takeaway? We've seen how Australia's banking giants, these institutions once thought unshakable, are navigating some really powerful currents of competition and regulation, and is pushing them to innovate, to change, at a scale perhaps never before seen.
That's right.
From their entrenched quadrupoly and the dynamic competitive landscape it now faces, through that escalating digital arms race and the protective yet costly regulatory fortress. We've dissected how these banks primarily generate their income and the powerful pressure squeezing their core margins.
We also examined the normalization of asset quality, things getting slightly worse from very good levels, and the crucial yet potentially fragile safety net provided by the housing market.
And finally, we took that closer look at the individual strategies of Commonwealth Bank, Westpac, NAB, and ANZ, highlighting their distinct profiles and that really stark divergence in how the market values them.
And just to reiterate, I think the key point is that while Australia's big four banks are undoubtedly pillars of stability, deeply ingrained in the economy, they are navigating an era of profound structural transition. There's no doubt about that. Their ongoing ability to adapt to that persistent margin pressure, fend off those nimble digital challengers, manage the escalating compliance and technology costs that will be the ultimate determinant. The determinant of their sustained profitability and their ability to continue delivering attractive shareholder returns through this incredibly complex period ahead.
So as you reflect on this deep dive, maybe consider this provocative thought. Can their strategic pivots like ANZ's Move with Suncorp or Westpac's Unite program and those massive digital investments truly offset these powerful headwinds, headwinds like margin compression and ever-increasing regulatory burdens? Or are we actually witnessing a slow, steady re-rating of what a safe Australian bank investment actually looks like in the 21st century? How much more will they need to adapt?
Mm-hmm.
And what genuinely new innovations, things maybe we haven't even thought of yet, might finally disrupt this fortress-like sector in ways we can barely imagine today?
Big questions for the future.
They really are. We encourage you to continue exploring the catalysts we mentioned and to connect these insights to your own financial awareness and decision-making. Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.